So welcome to you all to Glasgow's first Healthier Future Forum. We're delighted to see you all here, and it's a bit of an experiment, but we think it'll be great, so we'll see how the morning goes. I want to start with a story. One of the themes of today is a story, and the story I want to start with is the story of the Scorpion submarine, which went missing in 1968, somewhere in the North Atlantic, on its way back to Newport, Rhode Island. And the American Navy had no idea at all what had happened to the submarine. They knew when they had received the last update from the submarine, but they had no idea at all how far it had travelled since then, or what had happened to it, or how fast it was going. And of course they had to locate it, so one option was to call in some experts and get them to predict where the submarine might be. And doing that resulted in a search by the American Navy of a distance that was 20 miles wide and thousands of feet deep in the North Atlantic. And of course that was a process that was going to take many, many months, if not years, to complete. But one naval officer took a rather different approach, and he developed a number of scenarios as to what might have happened to the submarine. And he pulled together a mixed group of people from a range of different backgrounds. So amongst them were some people who worked in the Navy, some weather experts, some disaster experts, some mathematicians, some oceanographers, some politicians, some lay people, maybe some health people, maybe some local authority people, maybe some voluntary sector people, I don't know. But he pulled them all together and he presented to them this range of scenarios, not factually based scenarios, but scenarios that provided a range of options and interesting ideas about what might have happened to the submarine. And this group of people each used that information to make their own prediction as to what happened to the submarine and where it might be. And the naval officer then used the outputs of all of these individual predictions, collected them together, and worked out the group's collective view or advice as to what happened to the submarine. And it was 220 yards away from where the submarine had actually sunk in the whole of that huge, vast area of the North Atlantic. So there were no people in that group that actually knew what had happened, but their collective wisdom was such that they came up with absolutely the right answer. And that's just one of the many stories that are used to substantiate this idea of the wisdom of crowds. That collectively, if we work together as crowds, use our own insights, our own experience, our own information, we will collectively come up with the right answer. There are some conditions that have to be met to characterise wise crowds, and they're shown on this slide here. The first is diversity of opinion. People need to draw on their own private experience and their own personal knowledge, and we need to use that diversity to come up with our collective answers. The second is independence. Crowds don't work if you get groupthink. Crowds work if people are able to think about their own view, reach their own decisions, and then discuss those collectively. The third is decentralisation, the use of local knowledge, local experience and a range of expertise. And of course, fourthly, crowds need a process of aggregation back into some summary view. Crowds also need some rules to work by. Now, we don't have any rules today. This is a completely unregulated event. But we do have at each table facilitators. And perhaps facilitators could just identify yourselves, please, by standing up or hands in the air or saying hello or something. Yeah, okay. Or all of those at once, if you can multitask, that's fantastic. And the facilitators' jobs are to keep the discussions in the groups going, to make sure that people are allowed to express their own diverse opinions, and that that diversity and independence is used in the group, and to draw the group's discussions to a conclusion at an appropriate time. So that's the extent of the rules today, and the facilitators are there with a very light touch to try and keep this event going. But let's just test them out. I think it would be a good idea just to get some conversation going in the room. So could the facilitators please just have a little practice at your tables to see if you can do this bit about encouraging people to speak and just keep the conversation going for a couple of minutes. Thank you. Okay, folks, how did the facilitators do? They do okay? Excellent, well done. Right. So how's today going to work? Well, that was just a wee sample of it, a wee taster for you. We had thought about having an annual report event for the centre where we got people together and we talked about the work we've been doing for the last year, and everybody commented on it and we gave you our plans for the future. But we felt that might not be a particularly creative thing to do, and as you all know, one of the things we're trying to do in the centre is do things a bit differently. And so we've decided to provide you with that information in your packs. So you all have in your pack a report about the centre's programmes of work, our plans for the next year, and our new booklet, which has got number 2 at the front, so that lets you know it's a new one, it's purple. Please take time, not this morning, but after today, to have a look at that information. And if you would like any more clarification or any further detail, or if you've got comments on anything about what we're doing, please do get in touch and follow that up with us. And you've got all of our contact details in your pack as well. So that's there for you to take away, think about, and follow up with us after today. What we are going to do today is draw on one particular aspect of the centre's work over the last 9 months, and that's the lecture and seminar series that we've run. And I know a number of people in this room have been to some or all of the seminars, and some of you haven't, and that's absolutely fantastic. We've produced in our packs a summary of all of the seminars, so you've got that information at your fingertips today. But 5 people who've been very closely involved in working with the centre are each going to say a bit about one or two issues that have emerged during the seminar series that have made a particular impact on them and that they have found to be useful in reflecting about how they go about their work in relation to improving health in Glasgow and West Central Scotland. These will be personal reflections. They'll give you, if you like, returning to the Scorpion submarine example, they'll give you a taster of scenarios. You're not going to get the full information. You're not going to get an awful lot of facts and data presented today, but you'll get some pictures and some personal stories. And then we want this crowd together to develop its collective wisdom by using that information and data, bringing it together with your own experiences and knowledge to help us get a sense of how this Healthier Future Forum might work together, not to find a submarine, but to improve health and tackle health inequalities in West Central Scotland. It's a much more interesting and important question than finding a sunk submarine. Lastly, just by means of housekeeping, you have in your packs 2 notes sheets, and you'll see that they've got carbon copies behind them. If you're able to, it would be really helpful to us if you could just write your thoughts on these note sheets as we go through this morning. There's one for the first session, i.e. before coffee, and one for the second session, i.e. after coffee. And I'm sure you'll have worked this out already, but if you put one on top of the other, then your writing will go through both. So it would be quite helpful if you could separate them and just work on one sheet before coffee and then the second sheet after coffee. Okay, my last job by means of introduction is to introduce your starring cast for today. And they're all sitting at this table here. We have Professor Phil Hanlon, Professor of Public Health at the University of Glasgow. Valerie Miller, our communications manager from the centre. And Valerie is not only speaking today, she's been busy organising the event for the last fortnight, so thanks for that, Valerie. Harry Burns, our director of public health from Greater Glasgow NHS Board. Andrew Lyon, who's the converger from the International Futures Forum and organised our seminar series. Jim McCormack, director of the Scottish Council Foundation, who's going to be our rapporteur at the end of today and try and pull out some messages from the morning for us. Fiona Boyce, our team secretary from the centre, who's going to be looking after our audiovisual needs this morning. And Sir John Arbuthnot, chair of NHS Greater Glasgow and also chair of the Glasgow Centre for Population Health, and really the driver behind the establishment of the centre. And I'm just going to hand over to Sir John now just to talk a bit about his vision for the centre and his own personal reflections. Thanks.
Well, good morning, everybody, and this is a fantastic little hall, isn't it? Really very attractive, quite inspirational, and it almost tempts me to start singing. But I was speaking to Agnes Stewart before the event, and Agnes knows more about things in Glasgow than most people. She reassures me that there is, in fact, a digital cutout in this hall, so that when pop groups begin to perform at a level of decibels above that permitted by Scottish Heritage, the whole sound cuts out, so I can't sing at all. So thank you for coming, and Carol has, if you like, set the plot of this theme this morning, the new story. It has to be a new story because we can't stick with the old story. The old story isn't good enough. I want to tell you a little bit about my thoughts in playing a role in establishing this centre in order to tackle that very thing. She's also identified that we do have to have a goal in getting together as a crowd. In her case, it was a missing submarine. In our case, it is the missing information, which will allow us to understand and to tackle the gap in our health achievement here in the city and indeed in Scotland between our populations and similar populations elsewhere in Europe and in the world. And this is a gap that has persisted for far too long. We are doing everything we can in our various agencies, health, social services, voluntary sector, government, to close that gap. And we are improving, but the gap isn't really closing. So that's our missing submarine. I guess I began to focus my attention on this when I came back to Glasgow to become the principal of the University of Strathclyde, which is situated to the east side of George Square, and has a particular affinity with the schools and indeed the society of the east end of Glasgow. And it was in that time that I began to see the effects of deprivation on achievement and the huge effort which people had to make, sometimes extremely intelligent, bright, entirely capable students, but who came from backgrounds where achieving university entrance and then coping with the challenges were actually very testing for social reasons and for health reasons. And then in 1997, at the end of 1997, when Sam Galbraith asked me to devise a new way of allocating resources for health in Scotland, it became even clearer to me that this deprivation and health inequalities issue was huge. And indeed, the formula of the time didn't take that into account at all. And that's why I introduced into it a part of it, which takes account of life circumstances, which to a large extent you will hear today dictate how we achieve and how we achieve well-being and success and health, which are all part of the same story. Life circumstances and morbidity, because persisting with these circumstances leads to illness. And we had lots and lots of illness, and the question was, were we putting the resources in the right place to tackle that? But it all became mixed up because there's two major strands there. The first strand is, how do we best tackle people who are ill, and they're ill with chronic disease and acute disease because of their circumstances and because of their health inequalities? And that takes a lot of investment. But underlying all of that, which is the really big issue, and if you ever sit down with people to discuss health, they will almost immediately start to identify this, which is, we shouldn't get there in the first place. What we should be doing is actually improving the lifestyle and health so people don't get ill. At least they certainly don't get ill to the extent that we do at the moment and as early as we do at the moment. And that work concluded with, at least I think, a move towards resourcing the issue of treating people who became ill under these circumstances, but really didn't tackle the main issue, the gap, the reason for this gap. It did identify in passing that there was an unmet need, that there was actually a greater need out there, particularly in the socially deprived areas of Scotland, for healthcare than we were presently fulfilling, and that is still an issue, and the executive has begun to tackle that. When I became chairman of the health board and began to discuss with colleagues in the health board, Harry Burns, Phil Hamblin and many others, I actually became completely convinced that we had to adopt a new approach. In fact, what I found was that wherever you went in the city, if you went to a meeting or a dinner with businessmen, they were concerned about this because it affected their workforce and their productivity and their ability to make profits. If you go to the city chambers, they were concerned about this because of the social deprivation, because of the effects of that, because of the housing issues, because of the challenges and the amount of money that had to be put in to support people who couldn't make it. And of course in the health department we were concerned about it because that's our job. And in the university and the universities and in the voluntary sector, people were concerned about it all the time. And we found that we had a great team of people in our universities. But sometimes we were working more in Havana or Cuba or wherever around the world rather than in Glasgow. So the basic idea was, let's get this crowd together and write a new story. And by working together, as Carol has said, begin to really do something different. Now, I just want to finish by making a couple of points. Everybody had these ideas. There's nothing really new about that. But what people were all looking for was not simply a forum where we could discuss this and do more research. There was actually a premium on action. And this centre has been charged by me and by others, by the health minister. The health minister of the day was Malcolm Chisholm, who became a real and ready convert to this idea. And without his support, we wouldn't be here today. Malcolm wanted action. Everybody wants not just ideas and discussions, but action. And it is charged from its very start to begin to take action. And you'll hear a little bit about that. But to do so in a completely different way and to really open up the scope of our thinking internationally, bringing people in as we have with these lectures from completely different environments, not the health environment, who give us inspirational ideas, which provide the kind of catalyst that Carol described with this young officer whom I'm going to seek out immediately after this meeting, Carol, to get him into our centre, who can bring the impetus to get these ideas together. So that's how I became involved. That's how the centre has been formed. And it is working. It has a tight spring. It has a real objective to make a difference. And we will be judged on whether we make a difference. So that's the end of my story. It's been a fantastic time. We only achieve things when we actually get a group of people together who can at least identify with the vision. And we have done that, I think, in this group of people, which now extends very widely across the city. And I'm deeply grateful to all of these folk for getting together. And the next speaker in this to tell you a little bit of his story and a different emphasis in that story is Phil Hanlon. And we all know Phil. Phil.
In the seminar series, was kicked off by a philosopher. Seemed an unlikely beginning, but actually I found it truly inspirational. His name was Anthony Grayling. He's reader in philosophy at Birkbeck College in London. And he quoted many philosophers, amongst them Albert Camus, the French existentialist. And he quoted Camus as asking what he said was one of the key questions of philosophy, which I'll throw out to you this morning. Why not commit suicide? This was Camus' question. And it invites, of course, a reflection on the reasons to stay alive, to stay in the game, to stay involved, to do the stuff that we all care deeply about, that gives our life purpose and meaning. And Grayling used ideas like that to stimulate in his audience, certainly in me, the notion that what we needed was, first of all, the confidence to establish our own sense of ethos and direction, and the confidence to say that Glasgow, our city, needs a new ethos, a new story. That was Grayling's message to us, and that these two were linked, the personal and the civic. He talked much of the Greeks. He said of the Greeks that they were the first to really codify this notion that it was worth making the effort to work out how to live your life. He quoted Aristotle. I thought this was quite elegant. Aristotle said, for example, that the way to live the good life was to find the middle way, the balancing point. So, for instance, Aristotle said that bravery was not the opposite of cowardice. Rather, bravery was the midpoint, the balancing point between cowardice and recklessness. And Aristotle worked through a whole series of these balancing points to help stimulate in his fellow citizens a debate about how to live the good life. And out of these debates, out of the inner work the Greeks did, out of the debates they had, the books they wrote, the plays they wrote and performed, came a civic ethos. And that was Grayling's challenge to us. Could we create in Glasgow a new civic conversation to create a new ethos that would confront the problems that Sir John has reminded us, because that's all we need is reminded of, because we're all deeply aware of these. And I think these are deeply challenging ideas. But in the spirit of the morning, I'd like to use the second of my 5 minutes to tell a story, because we're in the business of telling stories. And it's easy to say we need a new civic conversation. We need a new sense of our own ethos. David Ogilvie, who's sitting there, and I have been grappling with some of this in the context of an article he and several of us wrote together on obesity, one of our public health challenges. And although our article in Public Health News has provoked quite a reaction, it's also provoked some misunderstanding and even abreaction. And so we got together as a group, we scratched our heads as to how we might take this debate on, and we decided that it would be best to grasp this idea of story. And David, bless him, came up in the train with an actual story, which was the fruit of our deliberations. And I'd like to share the story with you, because I think it makes a powerful point. The story is of Dr. Sisyphus, director of public health, another Greek illusion. Those of you who don't know your Greek mythology will know that Sisyphus was condemned to push the rock to the top of the hill every day, only for it to roll down and for it to be pushed up again, seemingly meaninglessly, each day. Now, we all know the Sisyphus moment, don't we? Primary care trusts. LHCCs. You know, we've all been through that treadmill of organisation and reorganisation. We can all feel a bit like Sisyphus. Dr. Sisyphus is the director of public health, and you see her rushing to the top of the stairs breathless as she carries her two excess stones. She walks to the top of the stairs because the little plaque at the bottom tells her that if she walks up the stairs every day, it's like climbing a Monroe. And so she abandons the lift. She sits down and she's frazzled because her secretary has taken the afternoon off for some obscure reason and she can't find her papers for the whatever it's called, the Extended City Healthy Whatever Partnership, blah, 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 partnership, with its 15 partners and 27 aims. And she's frazzled, and so she picks up her Doring and eats it in her moment of comfort, telling herself she'll go on her diet the next day. She goes to her meeting, gets back tired, is tucking into her Mark's takeaway meal, and has got the television on vaguely in the corner and is still trying to do some work. And she sees a familiar face. It's the local chief constable. He's one of the members of the partnership. And he's gone down and he's made his stand against the local licensing laws. And she thought, crumbs, that's brave of him. Head above parapet. Gosh. But she hardly notices and moves on. The next item, though, causes her great interest. There's a crowd of local residents standing in the high street protesting that the local planners have allowed the last fruit shop to be removed to be replaced by a McDonald's. This scenario actually comes from Dundee, where they had to do that. The planning regulations did not allow them to stop that change taking place. And these local residents in our story are there on the television, and there, in the front row of the protesters, is Dr. Sisyphus's absent secretary, Doris. And she can't believe this. She's a health board employee, for goodness sake. What will the partners think? And she's seized with panic. And then, worse, Doris is being interviewed. And with simple authority and real conviction, she's saying, this is not right. Local people need fruit, not another McDonald's. And she's at one and the same time inspired and appalled. What's she going to do with this girl? You know, this is against regulations. So she comes in about to discipline her the next morning when the phone rings. And it's Councillor Commoner, chair of the planning committee. Oh, heck. He'll be mad. What business has a partner got embarrassing the local authority? But Dr. Commoner in our story, or Councillor Commoner in our story says, wasn't that amazing yesterday? In fact, wasn't that your secretary? I'm about to, and before she says discipline her, Councillor Commoner says, she's dead right. For too long, we've allowed things to drift in the high street. A stand needs to be made. What's the point of the story? The point of the story is that Doris, acting out of a genuine conviction, acting authentically, is making a difference that Dr. Sisyphus, with her annual reports, her graphs, her statistics, her endless partnership work, is not making. The moral of the story is not that we don't need the partnership work, the graphs, the statistics, for all of them are the necessary foundation, just as they will be for the centre. But the point of the story is that just as the Greeks who made the most influence on the ethos of their city were those who brought authenticity, deep inner conviction and action to the debate, so too the Glasgow citizens who will create our new ethos are those who can do that inner work and can bring that simple, authentic simplicity to that debate. Thank you. Introducing the next person. My next task is to ask Valerie to come forward, and Valerie too is going to share her story of one of our quite fascinating seminar series. Valerie.
Thank you. Morning. I'm going to talk about a seminar that we had back in April, given by Richard Layard on happiness. And my story is in three parts. I'm going to begin by talking something about happiness, say something about simplicity, and also the need for change. Layard's seminar was the biggest of our seminar series events, so potentially many of you were there. And I'm not really going to go into great detail about all the points Layard had to make, and that information's in your packs, as Carol said, so I'm just going to pick up on those three points. Just as a brief reminder of Layard's thesis, he told us that at a population level, increasing income doesn't equate to increasing happiness. And although in the Western world average incomes have more than doubled in the last 50 years, our levels of happiness haven't increased at all. So I just really want to reflect on why that struck me as important. So talking about happiness firstly, medical and social science have now shown that happiness is an objective concept and it can be measured. But why is this of any relevance to us? Well, Layard argues that health is one of the goods of life, and happiness, in fact, is the good. So whilst health goes alongside freedom, accomplishment, entertainment, all the good things in life, happiness is the good in life. And we might take the viewpoint that happiness is a good thing because it helps us to improve our health. But Layard would turn this on its head and say that health is good because ultimately it improves our happiness, and health is a byproduct of that. So that was really the first thing that Layard said that struck me as important and worth thinking about. If we think of that in terms of health improvement, what we need to do to improve Glasgow's health, perhaps we don't need to improve Glasgow's health, we need to improve Glasgow's happiness, and good health will flow from that. And that links back into some of what Phil was saying, Grayling's lecture, and this is an idea that's been around for a long time. The ancient Greeks had the concept of eudaimonia, which was about health, and that was central to their concept of the good life. Also, if we think about poverty, there's obviously a strong link to poverty and ill health, but, and as the centre is looking at, poverty is not enough to explain the levels of ill health in the city. And Layard said the same for mental ill health, that in fact the least happy members of society are not those who live in poverty, but those who suffer from mental health problems. So returning again to the science behind happiness, Layard told us that the factors that are shown to increase happiness are factors such as family relationships, work, community and the friends that we have, as well as health. And this links to our idea about a sense of control, knowing our place in the world. And Diner and Seligman, in their paper, Beyond Money, they talk about how well-being leads to good social relationships. And it's not something that flows from having these good social relationships. So there seems to be a cyclical relationship there. Final point on happiness. Layard mentioned relative and absolute happiness and how relative means more to us than absolute. And he used as a cartoon in his book with the caption, "A wealthy man is one who earns $100 a year more than his wife's sister's husband," which I think sums that up. And I'm conscious there of a resemblance to what we do in Glasgow in terms of describing the health of the city. We never just describe Glasgow's health alone. It's always Glasgow's health is improving, but it hasn't improved as fast as other places. And in the ranking, we haven't moved up. And compared to other places, we haven't gotten any better, despite the fact that improvements have taken place. And that links into a bit of what Andrew's going to say, I think, about the Glasgow story. So the second part of my story is about simplicity. An overarching theme of what Layard had to say was that simple ideas and keeping things simple is important, and that was behind his concepts on happiness. If we take his definitions of happiness and unhappiness, he talked about happiness as feeling good and wanting to continue feeling that way, and unhappiness as feeling bad and wanting to feel different, which are very basic, straightforward definitions, but they're not oversimplified. They do say what we want them to say. So I really like Layard's approach in terms of this, that I think often we do have the tendency to overcomplicate things, and perhaps we can learn something from Layard here, and maybe in our discussions this morning we can be mindful of simple ideas and keep things simple. And just to mention change, Layard, as I'm sure many of you know, is an economist, and he talked about GDP and how GDP is used by economists as a measure of how the country is doing. But it's become more widely accepted that GDP doesn't take into consideration the quality of life of or the quality of relationships of the people who are involved in the production and consumption of the GDP. And so really it really only measures how the country's doing in financial terms. And I think this is maybe relevant to Glasgow's health and our approaches of health towards health improvement. Sometimes they can possibly be a bit like GDP. Some of the methods we use have been around for a long time, and much of them have been around for a long time because they are good, they do work, and that's why we continue to use them. But some of the approaches we take, or maybe that we're required to take because of the systems that we're part of, they can frustrate us and they don't seem like the right way of doing things, but they've become accepted practice and they no longer need to prove themselves, just as GDP doesn't. And Maureen O'Hara, another one of our seminar series visitors, talked to us about that if we continue to do things in the same way, or maybe make slight changes and expect to get a different result, this is actually characteristic of neuroticism. So that's worth thinking about. So what I'm trying to say here is our processes of working that have been long established can be very difficult to change. And certainly at an individual level, we don't really have the power to rethink and replace organisations and systems, so it would seem in our everyday working life. This takes us back to Laird, who suggests that the kind of changes we should be making are towards increasing happiness and improving health are in beginning to develop a better concept of the private and the common good. And he says this is about being yourself, appreciating yourself, realising that you're just as good but no better or different than anyone else, trying to understand your place in the world and moving away from a culture of individualism. And this idea grabbed me because perhaps the challenge remains in finding a balance between our need for evidence and measurable objectives and what actually really matters at a society level. Layard's argument is that public policy has a huge role to play in changing our national policies to reflect what really does matter and to help us to create the space to develop these concepts of the private and the common good. And if you're interested in looking at any more about this, the World Values Survey is available on the web and it looks at gradual changes over time in what people say they would like to get out of life. So just to finish off, I've talked about happiness, simple ideas and encouraging change, and what could be happier, simpler and more encouraging than a children's story? I don't know if any of you have seen this. This is Madonna's new children's book. And it's about a character called Lots of Dikasha. And it looks at this, the income and happiness divide, and the story goes, Lotsa was by far the richest man in the country. He had everything that money could buy, but there was a teeny tiny problem. No matter how much money Lotsa Dikasha made, he wasn't happy. And the story goes that he meets a wise old man, an owl obviously, who he explains his problem to. He says, I've spent all of my life making money so I could be happy. Now I have all the money a man could want, but I'm still not happy. And the old man was not surprised in the least. He leaned closer to Lotsa and said, there's a very important secret to be learned in life, but it's very hard to see and even harder to hear, so most people will miss it. What is that secret? Asked Lotsa, eager to hear the answer. The secret, said the wise man, pausing for a second, while Lotsa sat up straight and strained to hear. The secret is this, if you share what you have and put others before you, you will find happiness. Lotsa Dikasha was baffled. Is that it? He asked. That's it, answered the old man. I think that's a good place to stop. And if you're not inspired by Richard Layard, perhaps you're inspired by Madonna. Thank you. I'm just going to hand over to Andrew, who's going to start us off in this morning's discussion.
Okay, my role at the moment is to encourage it into conversation, and I want to do that by, I'm inspired by Valerie, and I'm going to quote one of my favourite philosophers, A.A. Milne. and £80 million at the beginning of Winnie the Pooh. You may remember the scene. It says something like, "Here comes Edward Bear now, coming downstairs behind Christopher Robin on the back of his head. Bump, 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 bump. He thinks there might be another way to come down the stairs. If only he could stop and think of it for a minute." So this is our chance now to stop and think of it for a minute. And we've been given two fantastic evocations this morning. From first of all, from Phil, ethos, civic conversation, the Greeks, what is the city all about, and so forth, summarised on the left-hand side there. And then from Valerie, about happiness, simplicity, and change. And so what we'd like to encourage you to do now at your tables for the next 20 minutes or so is just to have a conversation among yourselves about, are these interesting ideas? Can they be used for health? What might they be useful for in terms of your own work? And then at the end of 20 minutes, I'll draw us back together and we'll have 10 minutes in plenary together just to find out what these ideas have evoked so far. I'll be wandering around, so if anybody wants further help or is completely baffled or wants to hit me in the head with a microphone, then just put your hand in the air and I'll come as quickly as I can to give some help. Okay? And I'll call you back together in 20 minutes from now.